we will have more than accomplished our goal. Thank you for indulging this exercise in fantasy. Now I have a real-world assignment for you. I would like you to visit 3 different fast food restaurants of your choice, study the menus in them, and observe what the customers are eating. Then I want you to think about how closely those menus approximate the worst diet in the world we have just designed. Fast food has been one of the unhealthiest dietary developments in human history. It is mostly an American invention of the late 20th century, one that we are now busily exporting all over the world. Of course, people love fast food, especially kids. Already, it has changed the eating habits of a large and growing fraction of the population. I want people to change their eating habits to improve health, and I am especially concerned about the eating habits of children, because they often persist throughout life. I am also aware that unless healthy food meets the standards of taste, convenience, and reassurance provided by fast food, it stands little chance of gaining ground. You can easily construct the best diet in the world, in general terms at least, by simply writing down the contrary of the principles we just used to design a wretched diet, and by following the recommendations I gave you at the ends of the sections about carbohydrate, fat, protein, and micronutrients. Rather than repeat those recommendations, I would like to approach the subject by examining a number of very different diets that experts, including some nutritionists and physicians, have advanced as candidates for the title of best diet in the world. The Paleolithic Diet. Let's start with prehistory and look again at the Paleolithic diet. Some experts say that if we ate like our distant hunter-gatherer ancestors, most of our health problems, including obesity and cardiovascular disease, would disappear. As noted earlier, the Paleolithic diet contained no processed food and very little carbohydrate, since agriculture to produce grains had not yet been invented. It included a lot of meat from wild game, fish, some wild fruits, nuts, and tubers, but few vegetables and no salt or vegetable oils. To my mind, the main advantages of this diet are no processed foods with their unhealthy forms of carbohydrate and fat and a high content of additives, meat and fowl with lower and healthier fat content than modern versions and none of their residues of drugs and hormones, a very favorable omega-6 to omega-3 ratio in the range of 2-to-1 or 1-to-1, some wild seeds and nuts to provide fiber and micronutrients, none of the high glycemic carbohydrate load of the modern diet. The drawbacks of this diet are insufficient carbohydrate for continuous maintenance of glycogen stores, insufficient fruits and vegetables to provide fiber and micronutrients, especially protective phytochemicals, excess of animal protein with its consequent strain on liver and kidney function. Bottom line, few people in Paleolithic times lived long enough to develop the degenerative diseases that afflict human beings today. It is unrealistic to expect people to give up carbohydrate staples like bread and pasta. The task is to persuade them to eat smaller amounts of carbohydrate and better forms of it with lower glycemic index. I don't see the fast food restaurant of tomorrow serving Paleolithic cuisine. What we should chiefly borrow from this diet are its avoidance of processed food and its healthy ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids. Next, the raw foods diet. If food processing is the problem, some say, why not go back even farther in time to before the invention of cooking? A diet of all raw foods would certainly be more natural. It is, after all, the way wild animals eat. We know that cooking can destroy some micronutrients and create toxins. A number of doctors and clinics urge people who are ailing to eat only raw foods to regain their health, and I have visited raw food restaurants in several American cities. These are purely vegetarian, of course. Possible advantages of this way of eating include plenty of fruits, vegetables, seeds, and nuts and their content of micronutrients, no chance of fiber deficiency, little processed food, no flesh foods with the contaminants they may contain, little danger of getting too much protein or fat or the wrong kind of fat. And the disadvantages: loss of much of the best flavor, texture, and appearance of food, low bioavailability of many micronutrients, too many natural toxins in raw vegetables. Bottom line, these last two points require some explanation. The vitamins and minerals in raw vegetables may be much less available to the body than those in cooked vegetables. For example, the body cannot obtain lycopene, the carotenoid pigment that protects against prostate cancer, from raw tomatoes, only from cooked ones, and then only if fat is present in the digestive tract to facilitate absorption. A fragrant marinara sauce made with olive oil is a perfect lycopene source. Similarly, all the carotenoids in carrots become much more available to the body when you cook the carrots. That does not mean you should not eat raw carrots. It does mean you should eat some cooked carrots, say in soup, stews, or stir-fries. As for natural toxins in vegetables, I have written on this subject before, but still find that many people are uninformed about it. Some roots, seeds, stems, and leaves contain natural toxins, most of which are destroyed by simple cooking. Most raw beans are in this category, along with their sprouts. Alfalfa sprouts, much loved by raw food enthusiasts, are full of cannabinoid, a natural toxin that can harm the immune system. Common button mushrooms contain agaritine, a natural carcinogen. Celery tends to produce sorrelins, compounds that sensitize the skin to the harmful effects of ultraviolet radiation in sunlight. Our bodies have defenses against toxins in food we eat, but those defenses are overwhelmed these days, and it cannot do any good to add to the total toxic load they have to deal with. The occurrence of natural toxins in common edible plants, and the great potential of cooking to neutralize them, is a good argument against eating nothing but raw foods. The traditional Japanese diet. Until recently, the Japanese were the healthiest people on the planet. They are still the nation with the greatest longevity, an average of 77.2 years for men and 84.1 years for women. Even if most Japanese no longer eat the traditional Japanese diet, it is worth looking at because of its close correlation with very low rates of coronary heart disease and of hormonally driven cancers so prevalent in the West. This diet is very distinctive, including foods and preparations of foods not found elsewhere in the world. Its advantages are an unusually low percentage of total calories from fat, about 10%, for a cuisine that so many people find appetizing and interesting. Lots of fresh fish, but very little meat, and no milk or milk products. High omega-3 fatty acid intake as a result of emphasis on fish and sea vegetables. Astonishing variety and a vast range of colors, flavors, including bitter, and textures of food. Inclusion of a great many fresh vegetables, both raw and cooked and pickled. Inclusion of many types of soy foods on a daily basis. Few sweets, except for fruit in season, and little use of sugar, except in small amounts as a seasoning. Little use of wheat flour or other forms of finely particulate starch, except in noodles that are generally eaten hot or cold in low-fat broths rather than high-fat sauces. Inclusion of many wild foods, including vegetables, sea vegetables, and mushrooms. An emphasis on the aesthetics of food and food preparation that makes it the most artistic cuisine in the world. An emphasis on seasonality, eating foods in season, and harmonizing qualities of dishes with the qualities of the season. Consciousness of the impact of food on health, both preventively and therapeutically. Inclusion of green tea with its powerful antioxidant effects. As for the drawbacks of this diet, I would list many ingredients and foods too strange for Western tastes, the need for a great deal of time and work to prepare most dishes and meals, very high salt content related to the use of soy sauce, miso, and pickled vegetables, all containing much added salt, and sea vegetables with naturally high sodium content, these foods present at every meal. Low content of the specific kind of fiber from bran as a result of preference for polished white rice. Bottom line, the traditional Japanese diet is associated with great longevity and low incidence of Western diseases. It could be improved by decreasing its salt content and adding unpolished rice. Unfortunately, this cuisine cannot easily be exported except to Japanese restaurants. It is too labor-intensive and time-consuming, the quintessential slow food, and it includes too many items, textures, and flavors that do not appeal to non-Japanese. Nonetheless, it seems very worthwhile trying to incorporate into an optimum diet some of the principles of the traditional Japanese diet. The Asian diet. I see much in print these days about the health benefits of the Asian diet, even an Asian food pyramid as an alternative to the usual U.S. Department of Agriculture diagram with its recommended intakes of various food groups. The problem is that there is no general Asian diet. The different nations of the Far East eat very different kinds of food. For example, Chinese cuisine is nothing like Japanese, since it features mostly cooked food instead of raw, and much more animal protein. In northern China, people eat as much wheat as rice. Koreans eat more meat still, especially barbecued beef, and a great deal of strong spices like ginger, garlic, and chili. Thais eat fiery curries cooked in coconut milk, a lot of tropical fruit, and more sweets than East Asians. Vietnamese cuisine is heavily influenced by French cooking as a result of the former French colonial presence. Indonesian food includes elaborate curries and such unique ingredients as tempeh, a fermented soy product. Indians, distinct from other Asians, use dairy products in the form of fresh cheese, yogurt, and butter. They also like sweets very much and use a cornucopia of spices. In the south of India, where Orthodox Hinduism prevails, the diet is lacto-vegetarian. In the north, where Muslim influence is strong, people eat a lot of beef and lamb. So it seems to me risky to try to draw generalizations from such a mix, but I think that when people in the West talk about the advantages of the Asian diet, they mean a plant-based diet that includes relatively little meat, poultry, and sweets. Its advantages are lots of vegetables and fruits, fewer refined carbohydrates and less sugar than the Western diet provides, less and healthier fat, less meat and milk and more fish than in the Western diet, high flavor appeal through the artful use of herbs and spices, inclusion of soy foods, relatively few processed foods, tea as the main beverage with its antioxidant effects. Of course, these are all features I would like to keep in an optimum diet for people in our society. The disadvantages of the Asian diet, as you might expect, are too much salt, many unfamiliar ingredients, labor-intensive food preparation, unhealthy fat, refined vegetable oils, coconut oil, and coconut milk, depending on the particular cuisine, too much animal protein, depending on the particular cuisine. Bottom line, Westerners are learning to like Asian food. Two of the most popular restaurant styles in America at the moment are Pacific Rim and Asian Fusion, in which chefs often apply cooking methods and flavor principles of Far Eastern cooking to Western foods. They produce much more interesting and healthier dishes than those served at usual Western restaurants. The questions are whether this kind of food lends itself to home preparation, and whether large numbers of Westerners would ever eat it on a regular basis. The vegan diet. A minority of physicians urge people to eschew all animal foods, milk, milk products and eggs, as well as flesh foods. They may have been drawn to this way of eating by spiritual or ethical considerations, but now try to rationalize their food choices in medical terms. Vegan food can be either boring or delicious, depending on the creativity and sensitivity of the cook. Many Westerners forced to eat this way would probably lose weight, have better serum lipid profiles, and lower risks of chronic disease for obvious reasons. They would be consuming less fat, less saturated fat, less animal protein, and more fruits and vegetables than before, all changes in the right direction. The advantages of a diet devoid of animal foods are much less saturated fat and cholesterol than in a conventional diet, much higher content of fruits and vegetables, lower intake of environmental toxins. The disadvantages are lack of appeal for most people, risk of vitamin B12 deficiency without adequate supplementation, increased risk of omega-3 fatty acid deficiency, especially of EPA and DHA, increased risk of iron and calcium deficiency, unless foods rich in usable forms of those minerals are emphasized or supplementation is provided. Bottom line, in my experience, most Westerners like artfully prepared vegan dishes, but are unlikely to eat them exclusively. It is useful to know that one can make tasty food without using animal products, and I have already given my strong recommendation that you try to reduce the percentage of animal foods in your diet. But I do not see vegan cuisine becoming widely accepted in our society. The Mediterranean diet. Perhaps the most talked-about diet in recent years is a composite of the cuisines of Spain, southern France, Italy, Greece, Crete, and parts of the Middle East. The best-known contemporary champion of the Mediterranean diet is Walter Willett, Ph.D., chairman of the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health. He is the developer of the Mediterranean diet pyramid, which emphasizes olive oil, fish above meat, and cheese above milk. Willett is also the most prominent nutritional authority, urging us to pay more attention to the kind of fat in the diet as a determinant of health, rather than simply the amount. As might be expected, he has drawn criticism from advocates of very low-fat diets, who are upset with the Mediterranean diet pyramid because it fails to tell people to cut their total fat intake. The USDA food guide pyramid puts fats and oils at the very top along with sweets, with a cautionary note to use sparingly. In the Mediterranean diet pyramid, red meat is at the very top, and a whole middle layer is devoted to olive oil, placed just above a thick layer of fruits, vegetables, and beans and nuts. The advantages of the Mediterranean diet are great variety and tastes that appeal to people of many different cultures, lots of whole grain products as opposed to refined carbohydrates in the Western diet, hence a reduced glycemic load, mostly monounsaturated fat, and plenty of omega-3 fatty acids from fish, nuts, seeds, and vegetables, little meat and poultry compared to the Western diet, and more fish and legumes, inclusion of some cheese and yogurt, a great variety of fruits and vegetables, including low glycemic index fruits and vegetables providing fiber and protective phytochemicals, an emphasis on fresh foods, little processed food, use of familiar ingredients and good adaptability to locally available ingredients, relative ease of preparation compared to Japanese and other Asian cuisines. The drawbacks of this diet are very few. May not provide enough iron for growing children and pregnant women unless iron-rich foods are emphasized. May not provide enough calcium unless calcium-rich foods are emphasized or supplemental calcium is added. Bottom line, with few exceptions, the Mediterranean diet comes very close to adhering to all of the nutritional recommendations I have given you, as well as to conforming to all of the basic principles of eating well I have presented in this audio program. It is a style of eating that I like very much, and one associated with much lower incidence of obesity, cardiovascular disease, and cancer than in most of Europe and the Americas. And it is certainly a cuisine that offers much delight for the senses, not at all a cuisine of deprivation. I hope these analyses of diets will help you design your own diet for optimum health. Keep in mind that there is no one right way to eat, and that your nutritional needs may change over time. It is possible to adapt the principles of healthy eating presented here to a wide range of styles of food preparation, from Chinese to Italian. Eating well does not mean giving up everything you like. Even occasional self-indulgence in less healthy foods is not a disaster, and any steps you take to remedy what you are now doing wrong are steps in the right direction. Eating well simply means using a basic understanding of human nutrition to maximize as much as you can both the nourishing and pleasure-giving qualities of food. The United States and Canada are both experiencing an epidemic of obesity. When I return to North America from Asia or most other parts of the world, I am always amazed at how big we are, how many people in our two societies are really fat. It also seems obvious that we have been getting steadily fatter. I read recently that topping the list of Americans' gripes about everyday life is the diminishing size of seats in the coach sections of airplanes. In fact, the airlines have made coach seats a bit roomier recently, which leads me to the conclusion that passengers have gotten bigger. Recent medical evidence supports that conclusion. A survey conducted by the American Medical Association revealed that one in every five Americans was obese in 1998. In 1991, the rate was one in eight. And when I was growing up in mid-century, it was lower still. The markets now are full of far more low-fat and non-fat foods. Millions of us buy diet books and weight loss products. Millions more go to spas, weight loss clinics, and doctors of bariatric medicine, specialists in obesity. And North Americans are still getting fatter than ever. Losing weight has become such a cultural obsession here that people will embrace almost any scheme that promises success without asking them to give up the fattening foods they like. Currently, there are long advertisements on television for a weight loss product called Fat Trapper, composed mostly of chitin, the hard polysaccharide that makes up the shells of insects and crustaceans. It is supposed to bind fat in the gut and prevent its absorption. Chitin has been used to soak up oil spills, and the ads show pictures of it trapping fat in a test tube and dragging it to the bottom in a clump. But you could not eat enough chitin to make an impact on the fat you take in. If you did, it would wreak havoc with your intestinal tract and also block absorption of fat-soluble vitamins and protective phytochemicals. The most outrageous parts of these ads, and I am sure the most effective at promoting sales, are frequent scenes of lean, attractive people helping themselves to enormous servings of high-fat foods, pizza, cheesy casseroles, cream pies, cakes, and stuffing themselves, comfortable in the knowledge that Fat Trapper is protecting them from absorbing the calories and gaining weight. And if you order now, you get the companion product to use along with it, exercise in a bottle that will spare you the need of engaging in annoying physical activity. P.T. Barnum would be pleased. Unfortunately, the basic equation that relates caloric intake to weight is very simple. If caloric intake consistently exceeds caloric expenditure, the body will tend to store excess calories as fat. The simple fact is that so many Americans are fat because they are eating far more calories than they expend in their activities of daily living, and many people are simply unconscious of the excess calories they eat. Nutritionists recommend that moderately active adults consume between 2,000 and 3,000 calories a day, depending on gender and body size. If you are not careful about your food choices and portions, you can easily pack away 1,500 calories or more at breakfast, then have two more meals which will put you way over the top, not counting snacks. I repeat my assertion that the reason so many Americans are fat is simply that they eat too much, and too much of the wrong things. It is true, however, that certain factors can influence the basic equation. First and foremost is genetics. I have already mentioned the existence of so-called thrifty genes that allow some people to store up available calories as fat more readily than others. Such genes were a great advantage in populations that often lived near starvation or went through periodic cycles of feast and famine. Our distant hominid ancestors probably lived mostly in those conditions, which would have selected for the genes in question. And probably that is why so many people today have that genetic constitution. A common complaint of the overweight is, "I can gain weight just by looking at food." They have to do more than look at it, of course, but it is quite true that many of us are genetically programmed to turn available calories into fat as efficiently as possible. The problem is that those genes are no longer advantageous, with food and calories now always available to us in abundance and excess. All of us also know people who eat constantly and remain lean. In fact, some of them want to gain weight and complain of an inability to do so. They have a different sort of genetic constitution and metabolism, and would not fare well if the food supply failed. The principal mechanism by which genes regulate hunger and body fat is through an appetite control center in the hypothalamus, a deep brain structure that regulates many body functions. In each of us, this mechanism is set to a certain point, mostly determined by genes and relatively resistant to change. The setting keeps us at a certain weight, compensating for changes in activity and variations in caloric intake. This is the main reason that dieting is so frustrating. As you reduce caloric intake, the hypothalamus alters metabolism to increase the efficiency of turning calories into stored fat. And because a reducing diet, by definition, is a temporary regimen, as soon as you go off it, you will regain the weight. The only ways I know to alter the hypothalamic set point for appetite are exercise and stimulant drugs. In addition to increasing caloric output, regular exercise, an increase in daily activity, not exercise in a bottle, can, over time, change the basic equation in your favor and help you lose weight and keep it off. Similarly, stimulant drugs like amphetamine, cocaine, ephedrine, caffeine, nicotine, and phenylpropanolamine, or PPA, promote weight loss by an effect on the hypothalamic hunger center. Unfortunately, they are addictive, have potentially harmful physical and psychological side effects, lose their effectiveness over time, and set you up for rebound weight gain as soon as you discontinue them. So how can you use the information I have given you about nutrition and the optimum diet to get your weight down? First of all, you have to pay attention to the basic equation and both cut caloric intake and increase caloric expenditure. I agree with nutritionists who say that cutting caloric intake means cutting calories across the board rather than making any drastic changes in the ideal proportions of macronutrients. You should continue to eat about 50-60% of calories as carbohydrate, 30% as fat, and 10-20% as protein. But you must reduce the amount you eat, both by decreasing the size of portions and by cutting down on snacking, especially the kind of unconscious snacking that many people do as a nervous habit. That does not mean eating 3 meager meals a day. If you approach weight loss with a mindset of deprivation, you will not succeed. Instead, you must find a way to eat less while managing your hunger. Hunger management is not just about taking care of physical appetite. It also includes satisfying the desire for pleasure from food in all of its aspects. If you don't satisfy hunger during the day, you may find yourself eating everything in sight in the evening until you have taken in more calories than if you were not trying to reduce your intake. For me, hunger management means making sure I eat good food regularly. For others, it might mean eating frequently, 5 or 6 smaller meals throughout the day rather than the traditional 3. Everyone is different, and everyone trying to reduce caloric intake needs to satisfy their hunger in one way or another. If you find you simply cannot eat less, you may need to consult a nutritionist or dietitian for help with hunger management. There are also some practical strategies to try. The sight of food in variety and abundance stimulates overeating, which is why buffet dining can be disastrous. Try to avoid tempting displays of food. Try not to shop for food when you are hungry. Experiment with removing platters of food after you have served yourself. Better they should be out of sight in the kitchen than in view on the table. If possible, do not spend time in the company of persons who overeat or who encourage you to overeat. Although I have stated my objections to low-carbohydrate diets, I think the relationship between carbohydrate and obesity deserves more attention. Walter Willett, the champion of the Mediterranean diet, believes that refined carbohydrate, flour and sugar especially, is the chief culprit in the Western diet responsible for obesity. I agree with him and recommend that people trying to lose weight reduce intake of these foods using more whole grain products and fruit. Also, I am impressed by the number of people who go on low-carbohydrate diets and report that cravings for carbohydrates, sweets especially, disappear even as they lose weight. These are probably carbohydrate-sensitive individuals who do especially poorly with high glycemic loads of refined starch and sugar. They should be able to eat modest amounts of low glycemic index foods like whole grains, firm-cooked pasta, and fruits like berries and cherries. Some people tell me they have lost weight just by cutting out bread. I stated earlier that most bread today has a very high glycemic index because of the nature of the flour used to make it. I can believe that if you have thrifty genes and so gain weight easily, being careful about the amount and kind of carbohydrate foods you eat is the single best strategy you can use to control your weight. A good place to start is by cutting way down on foods made with sugar and flour. That does not mean following the Atkins diet or one of its spin-offs. Those diets appeal mostly to people who love meat and fat, who can do without starch and sugar, and never liked vegetables much anyway. The central problem with them is that they provide much too much protein, the consequences of which on liver and kidney function may not show up until much later in life. Too much saturated fat, and far from least important, too few of the protective factors in fruits and vegetables that are your best protection against cancer and the degenerative diseases of later life. For short-term weight loss, they are probably all right, as good as any other crash diet. But as a long-term eating strategy, they expose the body to harmful elements in food and leave it unprotected. You should also note that the epidemic of obesity here also correlates with widespread use of non-caloric artificial sweeteners, and more recently with the non-caloric fat substitute Olestra. Artificial sweeteners may be useful for diabetics, but there is no evidence that they help anyone lose weight. Not surprising, since people usually add them to items and meals already top-heavy in calories and refined carbohydrates. And I consider all of them suspect in terms of long-range effects on health. As for Olestra, a non-absorbable molecule that has the mouthfeel and cooking properties of fat, it is now used to create fat-free potato chips, corn chips, and other snack foods, and may soon be approved for many more products, including cookies and cakes. Consumer advocates have attacked it for blocking absorption of fat-soluble vitamins, which can be added to foods as supplements to compensate for any losses, and causing intestinal upheavals in some people. But the real problem is elsewhere. The use of this fake fat simply encourages greater consumption of low-quality, refined carbohydrate foods that are often high in sodium, full of unhealthy additives, and devoid of protective nutritional factors. People who eat them, probably more frequently and in greater quantity than they would eat the original versions, will be increasing their tendency to gain weight by taking in more of the wrong kind of calories. Finally, I want to say a few words about fasting. Abstaining from food has significant effects on body and mind. It can make more energy available to the body, at least temporarily, because digestion requires energy. For this reason, fasting at the onset of a cold can shorten its duration. Fasting can also be a technique to sharpen concentration, help you gain insight into the nature of the mind, and even develop spiritual awareness, hence its association with religious observances. It is not, however, a way to lose weight. Fasting prepares the body for starvation, slowing metabolism, and promoting storage of calories as fat when eating resumes. Now, a summary of what I have been telling you about weight. The basic equation relating calories in to calories out rules. If you consistently eat more calories than you burn, you will tend to store up the excess as body fat. Your weight and tendency to gain weight are strongly determined by your genes and mediated through regulation of the hypothalamic hunger center in the brain. Many people are genetically programmed to put weight on whenever calories are available in abundance in the body. Exercise and stimulant drugs can change the set point of the hypothalamic hunger center in the direction favoring weight loss, though stimulants should be avoided. Avoid all diet products, including supplements, foods, herbs, potions, and books, not to mention doctors, drugs, clinics, and programs that promise weight loss without changing what you eat or the size of your portions. Avoid diets that call for radical reshuffling of proportions of macronutrients, such as very low-fat and very low-carbohydrate diets, as long-term eating plans. To lose weight, decrease caloric intake across the board, maintaining the recommended proportions of macronutrients, 50 to 60% of calories from carbohydrate, 30% from fat, and 10 to 20% from protein. Pay careful attention to the amount and kind of carbohydrate calories you ingest, minimizing intake of refined starch and sugar and high glycemic index foods. In particular, minimize consumption of common forms of bread and other foods made from wheat flour. Be wary of low-fat and non-fat snacks and sweets that are high in refined carbohydrates. Avoid artificial sweeteners and products made with them or with the fat substitute olestra. Be wary of new pharmaceutical treatments for weight loss until medical consensus declares them to be safe and effective. Increase caloric expenditure by increasing physical activity. The kind of activity that may be most effective at promoting weight loss may be general activity throughout the day rather than intense isolated workouts. Walking, climbing stairs, housework, gardening, all contribute. Try to move more. Dieting is not the answer to keeping weight down. As you have heard many times, almost all people who diet to lose weight regain it, and more. Instead, you need to change long-term patterns of eating and physical activity. Hunger management is key. New patterns of eating must satisfy both physical hunger and the need for sensory pleasure from food. Estimate your average daily caloric intake by adding up the calories you eat each day for a week. Use standard tables of food composition to do so, and consult the breakdowns on packages of food you consume. Remember, it is very easy to run up total calories far above daily needs. Once you have done this, it is not necessary to count calories all the time. Just try to keep in mind how much food you really need given your level of physical activity. Pay particular attention to portion size of foods you like to eat. Develop a sense of appropriate portions by reading labels, measuring, and weighing foods. Avoid buffets and situations in which you are tempted by large servings of food. Keep serving platters out of sight whenever possible. If you like to snack, learn to snack on less calorie-dense foods and pay attention to the amounts you eat. If you have to have some chips, go for brands made with less fat and the right kind of fat, and eat a handful rather than the whole bag. Try snacking on fruit, raw vegetables, some nuts, even a piece of dark chocolate if you crave a sweet. Finally, if you are going to eat too much, as you sometimes will, remember that it is better to eat too much good food than too much bad food. A dish can only be as good as its worst ingredient. The optimum diet begins with knowledge of how to buy food, both for home preparation and when you are eating away from home. The most important piece of advice I can give you about shopping for food is to read labels. The information on food labels is now more complete and easier to read than ever. Begin by reading the list of ingredients, which are in descending order, from those present in the greatest amount to those present in the least. I usually reject any product whose list of ingredients is too long, the print too fine, and the space on the label barely adequate to contain it. I always look for the words partially hydrogenated, a cause for automatic rejection. And there are many food additives I won't eat, which I will discuss shortly. Then I look at the information under nutrition facts, starting with calories per serving and the breakdown into macronutrients. You should note the percentage of fat calories and the relative contribution of saturated, monounsaturated, and polyunsaturated fat. Also note cholesterol and sodium content. Check the total of carbohydrates and the amount of sugar and fiber, if any. Also look for the presence of vitamins and key minerals like iron and calcium. Let me show you how to be a good label detective by reviewing with you the information on several representative products, some good, some bad, some ugly. I'll start with a carton of organic vegetable broth from the new natural foods section of a local supermarket. The label boasts that the broth is all natural and fat-free, with no MSG added. MSG, monosodium glutamate, is a flavor enhancer and one of the additives I would rather not eat. The ingredients in this product are as follows: filtered water, organic carrots, organic celery, organic onion, organic leeks, organic tomato, organic garlic, sea salt, bay leaves, parsley, thyme. And the label further states that the vegetables were grown and processed in accordance with organic agriculture codes in Oregon and California. This looks great. Nothing in it I would not use myself in making a vegetable broth at home. I would, however, prefer a salt-free version so that I could season it myself, especially since a one-cup serving has 670 milligrams of sodium, almost a third of the recommended daily intake, which some experts would say is already too high. The nutrition facts portion of the label, where I found the sodium content, confirms that the broth is fat-free, and in fact mostly calorie-free. It provides tiny amounts, 2 and 6% respectively, of the daily recommended quantities of calcium and iron. So all in all, it is a good product, useful as a soup base, convenient as a flavorful addition to the liquid for cooking grains and vegetables. When using it, you would just want to taste dishes carefully to avoid oversalting them. Next, from the same part of the store, I have a natural soup in a cup, pasta parmesan, ready almost instantly with the addition of boiling water. The label says it's fat and cholesterol-free, with 40% less sodium than other leading brands. The list of ingredients looks rather long, but when I read it, I am reassured. The manufacturer has been conscientious in spelling everything out. It reads, linguine pasta, 100% semolina flour, dehydrated vegetables, tomatoes, onions, peas, carrots, broccoli, red bell peppers, garlic, soy granules, soy sauce powder, containing soybeans, wheat, and salt, natural flavors, no MSG, yeast extract, vinegar powder, Parmesan cheese, containing milk, cheese culture, salt, enzymes, sea salt, parsley, oregano, rosemary, white pepper, cayenne pepper, thyme, bay leaves, potato flour, natural beta-carotene. This is all familiar stuff, nothing bad. The vegetables listed are not organic, but the amounts of them are so small as to make that insignificant. The nutrition facts look good, too. 100 calories per serving, no fat or cholesterol, only 290 milligrams of sodium, most of the calories, 80 from carbohydrate and the rest, 20 from protein, and a bit of beta-carotene and vitamin C. But wait, I assumed the product contained one serving. But on closer inspection, I read, servings per container, about 2. I consider this deceptive. Maybe a small child would be happy with this as a serving, but all adults I know would eat the whole thing. That means 200 calories, not 100, and almost 600 milligrams of sodium, almost as much as in our salty broth above. If this truly represents 40% less sodium than other leading brands, just imagine how much excess sodium people get from eating leading brands. Let's try a healthy cracker, a form of Swedish crisp bread from a regular supermarket. The package says it's all natural, fat and cholesterol free, and made with 100% whole grain rye. The USDA food pyramid is reproduced in color here, with its base of bread, cereal, rice, and pasta highlighted, and the list of ingredients is satisfyingly short. Whole grain rye flour, yeast, salt. One cracker, we learn, has 45 calories, most from carbohydrate and a little from protein, along with 2 grams of fiber. 2 of these would give you a tenth of your daily fiber requirement, not as much as you might expect given their rough appearance. Sodium is only 40 milligrams per cracker, pretty good. This product is fine. Finally, let's look at a can of fat-free vegetarian baked beans, also from a regular supermarket. The writing on the label tells us it's high in fiber. The ingredients are prepared white beans, water, brown sugar, sugar, tomato paste, salt, cornstarch, mustard, onion powder, spices, extractive of paprika, garlic powder, and natural flavor. The Nutrition Facts label tells us that a serving size is 1/2 cup, but again, I would be more likely to eat a cup. 1 cup of these beans has 260 calories, 192 from carbohydrate, including 32 from sugar, not so much, and the rest from protein. It also provides a very respectable 12 grams of fiber, almost a third of the recommended daily intake, along with some vitamin A, iron, and calcium. The only bad news is high sodium, 1,100 milligrams, as we have seen a common problem with prepared foods and of concern mainly to the salt sensitive. These are examples of relatively healthy products available now in regular grocery stores. All of them get high marks for being free of unhealthy ingredients and additives. For the next batch of products, I ventured into the interior depths of the supermarket, going to sections I rarely visit. I came out first with a package of flour tortillas, sporting label banners reading premium quality and no lard, no cholesterol. Here are the ingredients. Enriched bleached flour, flour, niacin, iron, thiamine, mononitrate, riboflavin, folic acid, water, vegetable shortening consisting of partially hydrogenated soybean and or cottonseed oils, contains 2% or less of the following: salt, leavening, which is baking soda, sodium aluminum sulfate, cornstarch, monocalcium phosphate and or sodium acid pyrophosphate and calcium sulfate, propionic acid, calcium propionate, sorbic acid, potassium sorbate, benzoic acid, and phosphoric acid to preserve freshness, and dough conditioners, fumaric acid, L-cysteine, and sodium metabisulfite. That seems like a lot of unfamiliar stuff, but actually the worst ingredients are right at the beginning: enriched bleached flour, the prototypical refined carbohydrate, and vegetable shortening, which immediately disqualifies the product for inclusion in the optimum diet. The chemical ingredients are mostly innocuous: B vitamins, leavening agents, and preservatives to retard mold growth. I would prefer not to eat the preservatives, but I would less like to eat a moldy flour tortilla. One tortilla, weighing 51 grams, has 160 calories, 40 of them from fat and 10 of those from saturated fat, 360 milligrams of sodium, and only 1 gram of fiber. Most of the calories come from high glycemic index carbohydrate. This product goes back on the shelf. Next, I've got a bag of something called Cheesy Zigzags, cheese-flavored snacks that brag they are dangerously cheesy. Here we go. Enriched cornmeal, consisting of cornmeal, ferrous sulfate, niacin, thiamine, mononitrate, riboflavin, and folic acid. Vegetable oil containing one or more of the following: corn, cottonseed, partially hydrogenated cottonseed or soybean, or hydrogenated corn or cottonseed oil. Whey, salt, cheddar cheese consisting of cultured milk, salt, and enzymes. Maltodextrin, disodium phosphate, sour cream, which is cultured cream and nonfat milk. Artificial flavor, monosodium glutamate, lactic acid, artificial colors, yellow 6, extractives of turmeric and annatto, and citric acid. In addition to the problems of refined carbohydrate, this time in the form of finely milled cornmeal, and the terrible fat, we have monosodium glutamate and yellow 6, a synthetic food dye, which, according to my source book on food additives, has been shown to cause allergic reactions like hives, rhinitis, that is runny nose, and nasal congestion, and it also may be carcinogenic. The real shock comes under Nutrition Facts. The bag contains 10 ounces, 283.5 grams, of bright orange zigzags and says this is 10 servings. I think most people would eat a quarter of the bag at once. If you did, you would consume 425 calories, of which 250, or 59%, would be fat. That snack might give you nearly a quarter of your total caloric requirement for the day and almost half of the fat calories you need. Needless to say, it would not be good fat. The fiber you would get from this would be about 2 grams, next to nothing, and the sodium a hefty 925 milligrams. Back on the shelf with it. The next item is a box of sweetened rice cereal just for kids, made by one of the major cereal manufacturers. It has a kid-friendly name, and the box is decorated with currently popular cartoon characters and bright colors designed to make your children nag you to buy it for them. The cereal consists of purple flakes mixed with green reptile-shaped bits. The label identifies the product as a low-fat, cholesterol-free food with 10 essential vitamins and minerals. Here come the ingredients. Sugar, rice, rice flour, hydrogenated vegetable oil, coconut and palm kernel oils, corn syrup, salt, malted barley and corn extract, malted barley flour, wheat starch, yellow 5, red 40, blue 1, blue 2. There follows a separate listing of the added vitamins, A, Bs, and D, and minerals, iron and zinc. Note that the first ingredient is sugar, even ahead of the grains, a good example of the problem of added sugar in processed foods. All grains in this mix are refined. The fat is highly saturated, and there is a rainbow of chemical dyes. My source book says to use yellow 5, tartrazine, with caution, because it may cause allergic reactions and in children behavioral problems, worsening of hyperactivity and attention deficit disorder. It also advises caution about red 40, one of the newer food dyes developed to replace other banned reds. Red 40 is suspected of being carcinogenic. It is the most widely used food color and is mainly used in junk food, according to my reference guide. The book has even stronger warnings about the two blues, which it says should be avoided. The cereal is indeed low fat, with only 10% of its calories from fat, but all of that is saturated. The carbohydrate content is dreadful. I hope you can resist your children's clamoring for cutely packaged foods that are loaded with unhealthy ingredients. Finally, let's have dessert. How about real cheesecake mix, a no-bake dessert from one of the biggest manufacturers of processed food? If I were going to make a cheesecake at home, the only ingredients I would use would be cream cheese, sour cream, eggs, sugar, vanilla, lemon juice, and a crumb crust of pulverized graham crackers, butter, and sugar. Here are the ingredients of this mix. Filling. Sugar, baker's cheese, consisting of skim milk, lactic acid, cultures, hydrogenated coconut oil, corn syrup, modified food starch, sodium phosphate for thickening, partially hydrogenated palm kernel oil, sodium caseinate from milk, propylene glycol monostearate for blending, dipotassium phosphate, salt, mono and diglycerides for blending, whey from milk, hydroxylated soy lecithin and acetylated monoglycerides for blending, BHA preservative, yellow 5, artificial flavor, natural flavor, yellow 6, beta-carotene for color, citric acid, preservative, crust, enriched wheat flour, consisting of flour, niacin, reduced iron, thiamine mononitrate, riboflavin, folic acid, gram flour, sugar, partially hydrogenated vegetable oil, soybean and or cottonseed and or canola oils, molasses, high fructose corn syrup, salt, baking soda, BHA, TBHQ, and citric acid as preservatives. I don't think that needs any comment, and after reading it, I have such a headache that I can't even bear to look at the nutrition facts. I hope I have given you some sense of the importance of reading labels on food products you were thinking of buying. Let me summarize for you some of my advice about them. Try to buy foods that contain the same ingredients you would use at home. Avoid products that have so many ingredients they barely fit on the label. Watch for bad ingredients like partially hydrogenated oils. Avoid products containing artificial colors, artificial sweeteners, nitrites or nitrates, sulfites, potassium bromate, and brominated vegetable oil. In my opinion, all of these pose health risks. Minimize consumption of products containing MSG, monosodium glutamate, aluminum, and the preservatives BHA, BHT, and TBHQ. In my opinion, these may pose health risks. In checking nutrition facts on food labels, Make sure the serving size is what you would actually eat and adjust the arithmetic accordingly. When you are eating out, you obviously cannot read the labels of the products used in a restaurant, and you cannot know how carefully a restaurant manager shops. But you can improve your chances of getting high-quality food by making wise choices about where to eat and what to order. I enjoy good restaurants, and in them I like eating dishes I am unlikely to make at home. When I travel, I have to eat out, though not always where I'd like to. But I have found it easier in recent years to get healthy food in restaurants. Many now offer low-fat, vegetarian, and heart-healthy main dishes. Many have fresh fish, and some even emphasize organic produce and animal foods. I know I can always get a healthy meal of sushi and edamame at better Japanese restaurants, vegetarian appetizers made with olive oil at Middle Eastern and Greek restaurants, pasta with marinara sauce and a good salad at Italian restaurants, and stir-fried vegetables and tofu at Chinese ones. Often I eat fish when I eat out, because the quality of fish available at good restaurants is usually better than what I can get to cook at home. I am sure I do not have to tell you that there are many pitfalls to restaurant dining. Here are some tips for avoiding them. Portions of food in restaurants are often much too large. Don't always finish everything you are served. Consider splitting dishes with fellow diners, taking the excess home, or just leaving it on the plate. A friend of mine was once dining at a fashionable restaurant with the comedian George Burns and asked him how he stayed so thin when he ate out so often. Burns looked up and growled, "Eat half." Avoid buffets. The sight of large quantities of food attractively presented encourages overeating. Don't automatically eat bread and butter while waiting for your first course. Most restaurant bread is of the fluffy white high glycemic index sort, and you can take in far too many calories with it before you even get to an appetizer. If you find it hard to resist, ask the waiter not to bring bread until the rest of the food is ready. Eat small amounts, and if you have to have fat with it, ask for extra virgin olive oil. Many restaurants now offer it as an alternative to butter. Ask for salad dressing on the side so that you can put the amount on you want. Choose olive oil vinaigrettes if available, or simply ask for olive oil and vinegar and lemon if you wish. Avoid cream-based soups. Also ask for sauces on the side since they are usually high in saturated fat. Avoid fried foods. Ask for grilled or broiled fish to be prepared without butter. Ask for vegetables that are steamed or prepared with olive oil instead of butter. If you order rich desserts, try to satisfy yourself with a few bites rather than eating the whole thing. If the water you are served tastes like chlorine, order bottled water. Finally, I want to discuss a topic I consider important that nutritionists, dietitians, and doctors never mention, the spiritual quality of food. People in many cultures believe that food conveys something more than the sum of its nutrients, a form of vital energy that we need, or even the emotional and spiritual vibrations of people who have handled it. I share those beliefs, but I want to make clear that I have no scientific evidence to support them, and consider this whole aspect of food to exist in a realm separate from that studied by the sciences of biochemistry and nutrition. Obviously, there are differences between limp, tired carrots with yellow-green tops lying on the dry shelf of a convenience store and spiffy, bright orange and green carrots nestling under a mister in a natural food supermarket. Some of those differences have objective correlates. Under a microscope, for example, we might see protoplasm in the cells of the better-looking carrots streaming more briskly than in cells of the tired ones. It would be fair to say that the latter had more vital energy than the former, a distinction that might have to do with dehydration, length of time since harvesting, temperature, and so forth, all of which are measurable. The better-looking carrots will certainly be crunchier and might taste better, too. If both had the same content of macronutrients and micronutrients, would there be a difference in nutritional value apart from any difference in taste or aesthetic appeal? I suspect so. Now suppose we ask two different people to make soup from the same batch of carrots. The first cook is angry and resentful of the assignment, but follows our recipe exactly. The second is centered and peaceful and prepares the same recipe with love and a desire to give enjoyment to those who will eat it. Is there any difference between the two batches of soup? Would people eating them have different experiences or receive different influences on their bodies, minds, or spirits? I doubt that we could document such differences with our present methods. Controlled trials will probably not settle the question. Nevertheless, I believe there are differences. Most of us intuitively accept the possibility that food prepared with love is better for us than food prepared without it. The comfort provided by a bowl of mother's soup when we are sick may be much greater than that of a similar soup from a can or mix. It could be the thought that counts. It could be a placebo response. But who is to say it is not some vibrational quality of food that scientific instruments of the present do not measure? I would feel silly giving you rules about protecting the vibrational quality of food you buy and cook, but I would like you at least to think about this subject. We do not live by nutrients alone. As I said earlier, eating is a major source of pleasure, a primary focus of social interaction, a definer of individual and cultural identity, and an important influence on health. Think about the good feelings of comfort, security, and love that come from a meal prepared with care and love and eaten in the company of family and friends. It may be useful to keep some of this in mind when you shop for food, prepare it for the table, and select restaurants in which to eat. Pay attention to the feel of stores and restaurants and the people who manage them, to the aesthetic appearance of food, its freshness, colors, and odors, to your own attitudes about cleaning, cutting, and cooking the food you bring home. Enough said. I will conclude by quoting a verse from Lao Tzu. If the sign of life is in your face, he who responds to it will feel secure and fit, as when in a friendly place, sure of hearty care, a traveler gladly waits, though it may not taste like food, and he may not see the fare or hear a sound of plates. How endless it is, and how good.
Other titles by Dr. Andrew Weil, available on audio from Random House, are Spontaneous Healing and 8 Weeks to Optimum Health, both read by the author. This has been a Random House audiobooks presentation. Production copyright 2000, Random House, Inc., all rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.